So good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out on a Thanksgiving weekend. Today, I'm going to talk about loss. How we experience loss, how we suffer it, how we live with it, with resiliency. That might seem like a little bit of a gloomy topic for Thanksgiving weekend, but actually, I don't mean it to be, and you'll see why. It's actually a good topic for Thanksgiving weekend. So I'm going to start by reading a poem. This is by the Nobel laureate Derek Walcott. It's got a bit of an unusual title. It's called Odd Job, A Bull Terrier. Odd Job, that must have been his name. Here's the poem. You prepare for one sorrow, but another comes. It is not like the weather. You cannot brace yourself. The unreadiness is all. Your companion, the woman, the friend next to you, the child at your side, and the dog. We tremble for them. We look seaward and muse. It will rain. We shall get ready for rain. You do not connect the sunlight altering the darkening oleanders in the sea garden, the gold going out of the palms. You do not connect this, the fleck of the drizzle on your flesh, with the dog's whimper. The thunder doesn't frighten. The readiness is all. What follows at your feet is trying to tell you the silence is all. It is deeper than the readiness. It is sea deep, earth deep, love deep. The silence is stronger than thunder. We are stricken dumb and deep as the animals who never utter love as we do, except it becomes unutterable and must be said in a whimper, in tears, in the drizzle that comes to our eyes, not uttering the loved thing's name. The silence of the dead, the silence of the deepest buried love, is the one silence, and whether we bear it for beast, for child, for woman or friend, it is the one love, it is the same, and it is blessed, deepest, by loss. It is blessed, it is blessed. So how could this be true? What does he mean? The death of a child, a life partner, a friend, a beloved animal companion. Each is particular, unlike any other loss. How could such love be blessed by loss? He says, it is the one love, it is the same, and it is blessed deepest by loss. Well, you probably noticed that Buddhist teachings have many numerical sets, right? The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Six Paramitas, etc. And they're really helpful as teaching frameworks, and there's a lot of overlap among them. And loss belongs to a set called the Eight Worldly Winds. Pleasure and pain, loss and gain, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. These eight worldly winds blow us around and cause us much suffering because we reach for one and we try and push the other away. So we suffer unless we're really grounded in insight and patience and some measure of equanimity. We're exhilarated by one, right, by gain, and we're cast down by loss or by praise and blame, pleasure and pain. But we don't have much more control over those eight worldly winds than we do the squalls and breezes of the weather, really. Another numerical set is the three marks of existence, or characteristics of existence. And the first one is, of course, impermanence, right? Everything changes. And if this is so, loss is inevitable. And the second mark of existence is what's called no self, right? You've all heard these, I think. No self means that nothing in the phenomenal world has separate self-existence. That everything, you and me, the cell phone, this lectern, only exists, comes into and passes out of existence within kind of matrix. I like to think of it as a matrix of everything, right? Of connection, interconnection. And that's what the Buddhist term emptiness means. You know, when we chant, all dharmas are marked by emptiness, that's exactly what it means. Or boundlessness, maybe is a translation that works better. So the third mark of existence is suffering, and that's one of our themes, right, for this practice period. Dukkha. And that is what we experience when we're unable to see deeply into the truth of the other two, of impermanence and non-self. When we truly see and experience those truths, we don't suffer. Not in the same way. When we're always trying to hang on to and defend I, me, and mine, or we, us, and ours, the collective I, then we don't handle loss so well. Of course, there's many kinds of loss, right? Some losses are what we would call kind of necessary losses or developmental losses. I guess we could start with birth, right? We lose the warm, safe, more or less, environment of our mother's womb. And we're thrust into a bright, noisy world. Utterly strange. But we're too new and innocent to know the implications of what we've been thrust into. But we learn. When we start school, we lose another kind of innocence as we leave the family environment and go into the social world. I think this is less drastic these days. You know, when I was a kid, starting kindergarten was a really big deal, right? But now many more children start preschool or daycare much sooner. So I think the social world maybe is introduced more gradually. What are some other developmental losses where you lose one state and then as you enter into
baby the teeth.
You lose your baby teeth. Right? What else? Hopefully you get a little spare change.
Can you go from youth to adolescence?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a certain freedom that you lose from pre-adolescence to adolescence. Adolescence brings on a new kind of angst, usually, and self-doubt and all those things. What else?
Diapers.
who's gaining and losing there? What else?
Menopause.
Yeah, you lose that potential to have a child once and for all. How about being single versus in a relationship, right? You start a relationship, you lose the certain freedoms of being single. You end a relationship, you lose qualities of the relationship, and then you gain certain things about being single again. And isn't there that quality of whichever one you are, you miss and complain about not having the other? Empty nest. Kids grow up and move out. Even good things, right? You know, graduation or marriage, starting a relationship, you lose the previous state and have to let go of that and move into the next. And so that's why a lot of these sort of life transitions are often marked by ceremonies or rituals, right? Graduations. To kind of support and acknowledge and celebrate in community these changes. A number of people have said, I wish I could have a divorce or a separation ceremony to just kind of acknowledge and mark and be supported. So there's probably some we could do a better job of. And then there are the losses that come with change, right? Which is inevitable, right? Change of job, change of the place you live, moving, leaving behind a beloved home or town or country, homeland. Or as we've said, changes in a relationship. And even when we think of these as good changes, starting a new job, you're excited about our new relationship, they often, the change itself sometimes has more impact than we anticipate. And sometimes these changes are ones that we've chosen with a lot of care, and sometimes they're ones that are imposed on us by circumstance. Either way, they can be stressful, and we can suffer from doubt and anxiety. So how do we negotiate these life changes with a measure of grace and equanimity, with essentially resilience? So at the risk of repeating myself, it starts with self-awareness, with being present. We always come back to the same point, really paying attention to our own state of body and mind, our own reactions, noticing what our reaction to change feels like, or noticing what in it feels like loss. Yeah. What are the bodily feelings, the emotional tone, the thoughts that accompany that feeling of loss? And then can we be present with kindness to ourselves in that state of disequilibrium, with a sense of kindness and inquiry, kind of just questioning, feeling our way a little deeper. And therein, we can touch on both insight, that's the wisdom part, and compassion for this very human experience that we're going through. One thing to notice when we're in these states of feeling that we're losing, you know, losing something, is comparing mind, the mind of complaint and self-pity. Oh, my life was so much better before this happened, or I like my old job better. Why did I leave it? I miss being in that relationship. Why did I leave it? Or why did they leave me? The Buddha taught that comparing mind is always a matter of self-clinging, because we're comparing our state with someone else's as better, as worse, or even just as good as. That's all self-clinging, self-focused. And that comparing mind tends to feed doubt, which is as Michael talked about last week, doubt is one of the hindrances that obstruct clear seeing, and then thus clear acting and speaking in the world. Doubt distorts our view, so that we focus on the losses, the deficit, the feeling of loss or deficit, and we're blind to the new possibilities that are opening right in front of our eyes, sometimes through the changes in our lives. But with the greatest losses of our lives, it's pretty hard to see something opening up, sometimes for a long time. When we face the separation from those we love most, right, through estrangement, through the gradual losses of aging and illness, and ultimately through death. To lose someone we love is our most heart-rending experience of the impermanence of human life. We wonder how we can even survive. How do we find our way forward? Well, naturally, we actually do need to grieve and mourn our losses. Grief is a natural reaction to being separated from whom and what we love and need. The word bereave derives from the root rift, to be split, rent, riven, to have what you love torn away from you. And that's often how it feels, as though part of yourself has been torn away, amputated. People describe it like that. You may have felt like that yourself. So grieving is the way that we heal from and integrate, I would say, experiences of loss. Mourning, on the other hand, is the way we express our grief outwardly. So mourning varies, right? Mourning varies a lot depending on gender and culture and what we've learned in our families about what it's okay to express and what it's not okay to express. Our contemporary culture tends to have a back to business as usual attitude. You know, you get your couple of days of bereavement leave, and then you're supposed to show up and be functional. That's what George W. Bush told the United States a day or so after 9/11. Let's just get back to business as usual and show them you're not, you know, show them that we can't be beaten. So it's important that we don't use Buddhist teachings as one more way to suppress natural grieving. Buddhism does teach non-attachment, right? So we don't want to use that in a judgmental way. We are creatures of attachment. We're social beings. If we could not form the bonds of family and community, we couldn't function as human beings in the world. We need to be able to form healthy attachments, or perhaps we could say healthy connections. And part of a healthy connection is the ability to let go, right? Appropriately, and not hang on. To make without grasping, clinging, when the time comes to let a child go off to school or to their first job, to let go of your rigid ideas of how your partner should be, to let your aging and ill parent go when their time comes, when the body breaks down beyond repair. But because our need for connection is essentially hardwired, We don't adjust to the change of major loss overnight. We can't just wave a magic wand and make the pain go away. And that's where this capacity that our practice gives us really supports staying with the experience. Because the experience can be frightening. It can be very visceral. And it can take people by surprise, especially people who tend to be quite... live in the cognitive realm. C.S. Lewis, most of you, do you know who C.S. Lewis, the British writer, theologian, wrote perhaps the best account of this experience of grief. He called it a grief observed. He married late in life to a woman younger than he, a very talented, brilliant journalist, and they had a wonderful relationship. And then, I don't remember exactly, but it was maybe only 10 or 15 years into their relationship that she contracted cancer and died after a fairly short course, I believe. And then he wrote this. He wrote, "No one ever told me that grief felt so much like fear. I'm not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There's a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It's so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be around me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me." Has anyone ever felt like that? I used to, for those who don't know, I used to work for quite a few years for hospice societies, and I used to run bereavement support groups. And over again, people would say this, I really don't want to be around people, I don't want to be in social situations, but I don't want to be alone either. It was this catch 22. When you're going through these experiences, it can be frightening and disturbing. You wonder if you're losing your mind, if you'll ever be normal again. So again, being able to kind of track your experience, having that ability to take the backward step and be a good observer of your experience, even as you fully experience it. It's really, and with patience and kindness, is really what can give you the resilience to come through. Remembering always, over and over, to stop and breathe and be simply present while you drink a cup of tea or look out the window. Again, quoting C.S. Lewis, he says, "For in grief, nothing stays put. One keeps on emerging from, one keeps on emerging from a phase, but it always recurs, round and round. Everything repeats. Am I going in circles? Or dare I hope I am on a spiral? But if I'm a spiral, am I going up or down it?" Has anyone ever noticed that way? You know, you kind of level out and then get sideswiped by something that just sends you back into deep grief. But I think grief does continue to spiral through our lives as we continue to integrate our losses through our lifespan. Because the meaning changes, the meaning of losing a parent early changes when you become a parent, right? And then you miss your parent in a different way then. Many people say that, you know, if they've lost a parent, if a parent has died young, that when they reach the age that parent died, they have quite a rough year. And sometimes not even conscious of that at first. So we continue to make meaning of our losses throughout our life, really. I'm calling it loss, realizing that that terminology or wording is challenging, and we often use euphemisms for death, and some people really don't like it. I remember one person telling me, he's not lost. It's not like I lost him in the supermarket. He's dead, you know. And then, of course, we say pass away. But when I say loss, I'm including the whole range. The whole range. We first start healing from a major loss, from a death of someone we love. It often comes in kind of brief openings, like for a moment or 15 minutes. We become absorbed in life again, and something engages us fully, and we forget our pain. And when I used to work with bereaved people, they'd sometimes come in and report an experience like that, and then say, "Oh, and then I felt so guilty, you know, that I forgot my person for that short time." And I'd sometimes say, "Well, then, in your imagination, just tell them about it. Tell them about that moment, what it was like. And chances are, they'll be glad that you're coming back to life." The British novelist Julian Barnes, in this book, Levels of Life, writes about the months following his wife's death after one of those really short, like 37 days from cancer diagnosis to her death, those whirlwind experiences. He writes about it quite eloquently and poignantly, and also with that dry British wit, if any of you know his writing. He's very frank about his suicidal feelings and how they shifted. So I'm going to read you that part. He says, "It took a while, but I remember the moment, or rather the suddenly arriving argument, which made it less likely that I would kill myself. I realized that insofar as she was alive at all, she was alive in my memory. Of course she remained powerfully in other people's minds as well, but I was her principal rememberer. If she was anywhere, she was within me, internalized." And he says very clearly that he has no belief whatsoever in any kind of afterlife. "She was within me, internalized. This was normal. And it was equally normal, irrefutable, that I could not kill myself, because then I would also be killing her. So it was, in the end, or at least for the time being, simply decided. As was the broader but related question, how am I to live? I must live as she would have wanted me to." So there's where he turned that corner and felt her inside him. And when I read this, I remembered a widowed man. I used to have a group called Tea and Company for seniors who had lost a spouse. Whose spouse had died. And this man, this dear man, for months just would weep if he said anything about his wife. He would just weep. And then one day he came in with her blueberry muffins. She'd come alive in him. And he had this energy restored to make her muffins and offer them to the group, and something just shifted in him. So we do heal, and that's and our losses become us in some very mysterious way. And often we become more spacious, we can become more spacious, wiser, and more compassionate human beings through touching this deep human experience. And with gratitude for our lives, here's the gratitude coming in for Thanksgiving, with gratitude for our lives and our loves in their uniqueness, because only we had that particular connection with that particular person or animal or teacup, and they are us. That's our life. So when the clinging and that intense missing of grief begins to release, we open to gratitude. And there will come a time when the memory of that beloved person or animal or homeland comes with a sweet kind of echoing sadness, but not that sharp, sharp pain. And with gratitude to have had that love, lived that love. In Buddhist practice, we're encouraged to contemplate the inevitability of loss, of change, not as some sort of morbid preoccupation, but to remind ourselves that we're alive and that we can choose how we want to live. One way of doing so is to recite the five remembrances. And I'm going to see if I can remember them, the remembrances. And I didn't make copies for us all. So I'm just going to say the phrases and ask you to repeat after me. We'll do a call and response for those who might not be familiar with these. So it goes like this. I am of the nature to grow old.
I am of the nature to grow old.
There is no way to escape growing old.
There is no way to escape growing old.
Or old age. I am of the nature to have ill health.
I am of the nature to have ill health.
There is no way to escape having ill health.
There is no way to escape having ill health.
I am of the nature to die.
I am of the nature to die.
There is no way to escape death.
There is no way to escape death.
All that I love, everything. Everything that, all that I love and everything that I hold dear, I will be separated from.
All that I love and everything that I hold dear, I will be separated from.
There is no way to escape this separation.
There is no way to escape this separation.
My deeds are my only companions.
My deeds are my only companions.
My deeds flow on without limit.
My deeds flow on without limit.
My deeds are the ground on which I stand.
My deeds are the ground on which I stand.
So that's pretty close to how it goes. The first four remembrances, right? We're looking at the deep truth of impermanence, of sickness, old age, and death. And they help us relax that grip of clinging, of self, of need to control, the self-centered mind's need to control. But the fifth one, about my deeds, helps us to see the truth of infinite interconnection. Deeds means karma. Probably the original word was karma, because karma means action. And by that, we don't mean the kind of popular usage of fate or predestination. The law of karma is the law of cause and effect, right? Beneficial actions have beneficial effects. Harmful actions have harmful effects. And our actions that may seem on the surface to be beneficial can sometimes be kind of subtly contaminated, right? By our self-clinging, by our anger, our fear, competitiveness, need for recognition. And so those actions might have mixed consequences. In fact, most of our actions are not purely good or purely evil, right? They're mixed. Mixed bag of muddled motivations and habit patterns. It takes a lot of practice to bring mindful awareness to our intentions, our actions, and our speech. So we're always, that's what we do when we, you know, come to our precept ceremony and we say, all my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. So we're continuously refining our karma. It's not just a done deal. But what this fifth remembrance, along with those others, means is that what forms us is our karma, our interrelationships with everyone and everything in our environment. And what survives us is the outflow of our karma, the consequences of how we have lived our lives. So as long as we are alive and conscious, it's never too late. It's never too late to purify, to refine our karma, to choose to act and speak with kindness and patience and forgiveness. So making this choice, how then shall I live, is really key in the territory of loss, you know, not to become distorted, contracted. There are those who, on their deathbed, and I think anyone who's worked in the area of hospice care has probably seen this, those who in their final days or hours have a strong need to make amends, to give or receive forgiveness, to meet that one person who they need to ask or receive forgiveness from before they die. So practicing these five remembrances supports us not to wait till we're on our deathbed to let go and embrace our lives. So that when the time does come for us to let go of our own lives, we can do that with some grace. So I'm going to close with another poem about loss, and this one's by Mary Oliver. It's well known, so probably some of you have heard it, but I think it bears repeating. It's called In Blackwater Woods. Look, the trees are turning their own bodies into pillars of light, are giving off the rich fragrance of cinnamon and fulfillment. The long tapers of cattails are bursting and floating away over the blue shoulders of the ponds. And every pond, no matter what its name is nameless now. Every year, everything I have ever learned in my lifetime leads me back to this. The fires and the black river of loss, whose other side is salvation, whose meaning none of us will ever know. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things. To love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes to let it go, to let it go. So with gratitude to the great poets who wrote about suffering and resilience, if we didn't have suffering, we wouldn't have the great poetry and literature of the world, would we? So, we have one more day of this Thanksgiving weekend. So I hope maybe you can find a place of gratitude in your heart, even within the knowledge of the losses that you've had in your life and the loves that you've had in your life, large, great and small. So thank you for listening, and now I'm gonna invite you